Accession number 18035, Reel 2.
Interesting that when I was able to compare notes with Ludwig Butko, who was the managing director of NBB, and of course we were associated with him in the Tornado program in British Aerospace. He was working on much the same sort of problem. He was Willy Messerschmitt's aerodynamicist at the time. And when we were discussing this, we were standing on the wing of an ME-262 in the Deutsches Museum in Munich. And I remarked that it seemed to me the maximum thickness core was around about 40%. And he said, yes, that's the conclusion that we came to.
This was intent. Is this with the final
it's not the thickness chord ratio of the wing, it's the position of the maximum thickness chord along the chord line.
Oh, I see.
So that the maximum thickness of any individual section is not 30% back from the leading edge, it's at 40% back from the leading edge. And you'll find that all the modern sections tend to have this rearward position of the maximum thickness. And associated with this, there was a design of a mathematical design of the camber line to suit the operating conditions of the aircraft. So the Tempest wing ended up with a brand new section, a much thinner section, and an elliptical wing with chopped off tips. You could have got the same effect with a parallel taper center section and a straight taper outer section, but we didn't think Cam would like that.
Too many echoes of the Spitfire, were there, or what?
No. There's a very good reason for the elliptical wing, a very good one, that you had to house, you realised by then, 4 20mm cannon were the standard armament, gunned. And these were quite bulky, and if you were to accommodate the big Hispano cannon, plus their feed mechanism and ammunition, you needed plenty of room in the wing outside the propeller. And the elliptical wing gave you a good long cord just outside the propeller disc.
And accordingly more thickness.
And accordingly more thickness for a given thickness chord ratio. So that was the sort of argument. As I say, you could have achieved the same result with parallel centre section and a straight taper outer section, but it wouldn't have looked as nice. The other thing that had to be done with the Tempest was to improve, to make it a first-class combat aircraft, was to improve the rate of roll. So the ailerons, hence the sawn off tips. We developed some spring tab ailerons, which greatly reduced the operating forces, made them a good deal more uniform and manageable across the whole speed range, and much more easily repeatable. The old freeze balances were terribly sensitive, and although very simple, they varied pretty much in the control characteristics from aircraft to aircraft. These spring-tab ailerons, which incidentally we took out a patent, I still have a copy of it, were associated with double elliptic sprockets in the drive mechanism, which again greatly helped the distribution of forces across the speed range. And there's been a recent book, The Typhoon and Tempest by Mason, which particularly emphasises two characteristics of the Tempest. Its improved performance at altitude, rising from the improved wing, and the vast improvement in controllability. It was much more, in other words, a fighting aeroplane, air-to-air combat.
And it saw operational service, presumably, did it, before the war?
Yes, yes, and in fact, a number of people like Bill Humble, Philip Lucas, of course, and particularly Beemot played a big part in its development. Because, you know, B had two spells at Hawkers as a test pilot. Yes, on loan from...
I read his book, The Testing Years.
Yes. And he did a lot, actually, with the in-flight measurement of tail loading on the Typhoon, which was fairly hazardous stuff, because we asked him to do some things that... that calls tails to, well, to fly the aircraft under circumstances in which the tailplane has departed previously. One thing I remember with astonishment is when checking the effect of rudder loading, B, who was a fairly powerful chap, managed to clock significantly more foot force than the then design regulations suggested as a maximum. Anyway, there were various other things involved, the Tempest, like the big radial Centaurus on the Tempest 2. One of the things there was getting the cooling right. And that was an interesting job. We had to invent some new types of cooling gills to control the airflow for that. But by then, or shortly afterwards, the war in Europe came to an end. The English Electric Company, that had had a tremendous success producing Halifax bombers during the war years, was being encouraged by some people in Whitehall to start up a new design department. This wasn't viewed with much favour by the rest of the industry. The late Lord Nelson had chosen Teddy Petter from Westlands as his chief engineer, and Teddy Petter got in touch with me in 1944 and said, that's the end of 1944, and said, did I want to join a new venture with him up in the north? And at that stage, the war was still on, and it wasn't the time to move. But he unrolled some early drawings of his thoughts for a light bomber on the floor of our flat in Caseland. This had a big double-sided centrifugal jet engine, a sort of blown-up Neen in the middle of the fuselage. So it was in fact quite different from the Canberras that originally happened. But
and it was a jet aircraft, which presumably was so jet unusual anyway.
Well, but at that time, of course, the there were jet aircraft flying in this country. But as you say, it was new as far as I was concerned. Mm. And of course, it was a jolly interesting challenge. We kept in contact. The upshot of it was that I moved. We moved north in 1945 after the war was over in Europe. By that time, I was married. We married in 1940. My wife Kathleen has been a terrific support and help throughout the whole of my time from 1940 onwards. And we had one small child and another one on the way. I asked Kathleen whether she was prepared to have a go of the new enterprise in far up in the north, around Preston. And she very gamely said, yes, okay, let's give it a try, which was very brave of her. So off we went. At that time, the sort of thing which was being said in Whitehall was that there were going to be no more new aircraft for 10 years, because there wouldn't be another war for some time, and we could sort of sit around and think. We had no staff other than Teddy Petter, a chap he had brought with him from Westlands, Harry Harrison, and myself. We had no contract, and we were housed in a converted garage. It was a fair size
garage. Actually, more than itself,
this was in Corporation Street, Preston. Next door was a rather ramshackle funeral, an undertaker. We sort of said, well, we've got to make a go of this, or the guy next door is going to bury us. So it had to work. I went there as chief stressman and was involved with structure, weight. And I'm happy to say the weight actually of the Canberra actually came out rather lower than originally forecast. It would have been even lower if the Aidan hadn't turned out very much heavier than originally forecast. I was also responsible for structural and mechanical testing and so on. The experience gained at Hawkers was immensely valuable because Teddy Petter wanted to keep the Canberra as simple as possible, and therefore didn't want power controls, so it had spring tab controls. We used a modified form of the spring tab control for the camera, and they seemed to have worked all right. That was an immensely interesting period, because one seldom gets the opportunity to be in at the start of something, a greenfield operation, although there weren't any greenfields in sight from Corporation Street, the old garage, mostly somewhat grubby buildings, but you know what I mean. An operation built up right from scratch is really tremendous.
I'm a bit curious. A little while back you said that the attitude in Whitehall was that there were going to be no new aeroplanes, and yet somehow the Bomber Command specification that became the Canberra was going ahead. I mean, they were paying you to develop it, weren't they? Or was it a private venture?
Initially, the early work was funded by the English Electric Company. Mm-hmm. Then we picked up an experimental contract, and a lot of good aeroplanes have started with experimental contracts. The original Canberra specification was for had an E number, E for experimental. That was later changed to the sort of B345, I think it was. But so you would get an experimental contract, which we did. I mean, fortunately, Whitehall wasn't entirely populated by short-sighted people. There were a few people who were prepared to get round the original 10-year no aeroplane thinking by letting out experimental contracts, you see. And this enabled us to start recruiting staff, because the Control of Employment Act was still on then.
That required what?
Well, you had to have a contract. We were faced rather with a catch-22 situation, because you had to have a contract in order to get staff, and you had to have staff to get a contract. So getting an experimental contract, which you could do with a very limited number of staff, initially just the three of us, was quite a useful thing, and it got round our problem, you see. Anyway, the staff gradually built up. Don Crowe joined. He was the Handley Page chap allocated to English Electric. He joined us and was a tower of strength. And so the design of the Canberra progressed. Roles were converted partly by Griffith to the axial flow concept, and there was a session down in Derby where the Avon originated and was designed, the original Avon, specifically for the Canberra, or what became the Canberra. That was the B345 at that time. Things went on quite rapidly. The original pair of wings was actually built in the main workshop of the garage.
Not your garage.
No, the garage in Corporation Street, where we were all housed.
So you lived above the shop then? I mean, you said you were in a converted garage.
Oh, no. I mean, the design team was in the
garage. Oh, I misunderstood you. No, I thought no, your family were.
No. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. No, we'd found a place up in Penwortham. At that time, the BBC hadn't succeeded in producing a standard sort of dialect, or reasonably standard dialect, throughout the country, an understandable one. And when we were looking for a place to live, I remember there was one we located, which we eventually lived in, up in Penwitham. And we asked the way to the particular road by a local, and he said, "Oh, aye, up the roof." So we scratched our heads for a bit and worked on that. And of course, it was up just at the top of, over the top of the hill.
Of course,
of course.
Anyhow, anyway, you built the wings of the Canberra?
In the garage where the design team was housed. The rest of it was built in the English Electric factories, which were, of course, run by a formidable character, Arthur Sheffield, who was a superb factory manager. But not everybody could get on with him, and so on. More of that later. As the aircraft developed, it was thought it would be a good thing to have somewhere to fly it from. And there was a large, or there had been a large United States 8th Air Force reception and overhaul base at Wharton. In fact, when I first went up to Preston, you could still see enormous numbers of Flying Fortresses, Mitchells and so on parked all around the field. That was in 1945. By 1947 they had gone, but the airfield was still there, plus some very useful hangars. That airfield was acquired for use. It was owned then by the Ministry of Defence, and by that time B had joined us as
the test pilot.
Oh well, there were test pilots, you see, flying the Halifaxes,
yeah,
from Salisbury, which was the main production assembly base on the other side of Preston.
Uh-huh.
Wharton was west of Preston, Salisbury was east of Preston. But there were limitations on the length of the field, at length of the runway at Salisbury, and the weather factor was nowhere near as good at Salisbury because it was further inland, nearer the hills and so on. Wharton was ideal for development testing of aircraft because of the large flat marshes and, of course, ultimately with supersonic aircraft, access to supersonic ranges over the sea. And then there were also bombing ranges within easy reach, both in Wales and in Scotland. B did some early work. Was really the first inhabitant of Wharton with a Meteor.
They were being subcontracted, were they? I mean, EE were building them.
No, this was preparatory work investigating high-speed phenomena, because, you see, the Canberra lived in the same sort of speed regime as the Meteor. And in fact, was at stages rather faster and flew rather higher. The activities at Wharton weren't very popular because there had been a nasty accident during the war when a B-17 operating from Morton had crashed on the local school, killing a lot of children. So there was a certain amount of local resentment. That all disappeared later, and the whole setup was very amicable in later years, because we provided a lot of employment and pumped a lot of money into the area. The Canberra programme proceeded apace. By then it had become fully blown specification. The Whitehall thinking, of course, had changed from its original status, and not only was the Canberra going full bore, but there were no less than three or four V-bombers starting up in the early stages, which was a fantastic turnaround. So it was lucky we didn't believe the original no more aircraft for 10 years. The first Canberra flew on Friday the 13th of May 1949. Earlier there had been some workup tests. Bee was very keen on doing hops just to check. And the extraordinary thing that the camera did, it took off, did a short hop along the runway and landed. And the runway, which was uh, 1900 yards,
just over a mile, in other words.
Yes. Or say under 6,000 feet. You could do it with the Canberra because of the low wing loading. The original specification for the Canberra was, the design, real design point, was 0.75 Mach number cruise at 45,000 feet with full internal bomb load. And consequently, we'd used a large wing area to keep the lift coefficient reasonable, and again a wing section with a maximum thickness chord ratio around 40% rather than 30%. This had other benefits. The section also was designed so as to provide a good deal of laminar flow over the leading edge of the wing, and the leading edge of the wing was constructed in such a way as to provide a very smooth surface. And the leading edge of the wing was constructed in such a way as to provide a very smooth surface. And this seemed to work quite well because the actual drag of the Canberra worked out slightly lower than predicted. It had slightly lower, it had slightly more fuel than strictly required, and the weight was slightly lower than forecast. So its performance therefore beat specification by a reasonable margin. And he made it a very flexible aeroplane.
When he was doing these hops, I mean, what sort of speed was he unsticking at? You know, with a sort of tumbler full of fuel.
Oh, quite a low speed, because the hops were done without any bomb load, with minimum, absolute minimum fuel. So I can't remember offhand